listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Have you ever been conned? Perhaps a car dealer talked you into a more expensive car. You came home with that Prius you weren't expecting to buy, or maybe you came home from the animal shelter with a pot-bellied pig you weren't planning on, and you might even be one of those susceptible souls who once wired cash to an old friend who emailed you that they were stranded without funds in Lisbon. But Christian Karl Gerhardsreiter, a secret banker and art collector who claimed to be part of the Rockefeller clan and who, as Walter Kern puts it, was, quote, bulging with lies, his scams were of a different order entirely. Clark Rockefeller was more than a normal liar. He was an artful liar, a liar so skilled at making up stories that you had to wonder if he had a doppelganger somewhere smoothing out the way. Plenty of people fell for his imposter's stories, including one successful woman, a Harvard graduate, who married him and had his child, a little girl whom Clark later abducted, which led to his arrest, his unmasking, and an eventual murder charge. He's now serving 27 years to life in an American prison. Walter Kern's stunning new book, Blood Will Out, The True Story of a Murder, a Mystery, and a Masquerade, is his fascinating, eerie, an unlikely tale of having been duped over the course of a 15-year relationship with Rockefeller. Clark Rockefeller was good at sizing people up for their potential utility. However, it's Kern, the writer, who finally triumphs, deconstructing Rockefeller's con and, with painful honesty, his own reasons for falling for it. Walter Kern is the author of Thumbsucker and Up in the Air, both made into major films. He's also the author of the 2009 memoir, Lost in the Meritocracy, another funny, self-mocking memoir that takes fakery as one of its themes. His work appears in many publications. Many of you might have read his recent interview with himself in the New York Times Arts and Leisure section. It was a great piece. In conversation with Walter tonight, I think we've found the right man. Richard Rayner is the author of 10 books, both fiction and nonfiction, including Los Angeles Without a Map, which was filmed from his own script, The Blue Suit, Murder Book, and most recently, A Bright and Guilty Place, Murder, Corruption, and LA's Scandalous Coming of Age, where he channels Raymond Chandler in telling the story of Los Angeles in its defining moment, the late 20s and early 30s. Richard teaches at USC. Please join me now in welcoming Walter Kern and Richard Rayner. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming out, and we're going to be talking about Walter's extraordinary, scary new book, which has been reminding me of the slitheriness of my own personality in an uncomfortable way ever since I read it. It's a book in which the timeline is surprisingly long and important, and you meet this man who's posing as a member of the Rockefeller family, who will much, much later be revealed to be a serial imposter who's dismembered at least one person and buried them in the backyard of a house in South Pasadena shortly before holding a Cluedo party there. The distance in time between those moments of your meeting him in 1998 and then the gradual unearthing of the crime, which starts with another crime in 2008. This relationship happens over a long period of time, and perhaps you can just talk us through how you actually first swam into this, on the one hand, preposterous, on the other hand, completely compelling individual's orbit?
Okay, it's 1998. I'm living in Montana. I've got a child on the way. I've just taken out a mortgage that's way too big. I'm between books, which for me is like being between ships for a merchant marine. You're hanging out on the docks looking for trouble, kind of. And the local Humane Society got in a dog that was crippled and in a wheelchair, and they put it up on the internet for adoption, and got a call from New York City from a man, Clark Rockefeller, who introduced himself as a neighbor of Tony Bennett's, the singer, as a banker, and so on. And he wanted desperately to adopt this dog. There was only one problem. He couldn't drive out because he didn't have a driver's license to Montana and get it. And his private jet, he said, was in China with his wife that summer. So the Humane Society, which was led by my wife, and hoped to get him this dog because a Rockefeller might show his gratitude for this adoption with a very big contribution, came to me and said, Walter, you used to live in New York. You went to Princeton. Maybe you can talk to this guy. I talked to him on the phone. He was immediately the most outlandish character I'd ever met. He told me, for example, that he'd never eaten in a restaurant, and he asked me what Coca-Cola tasted like.
This is over the phone?
Over the phone. He told me his other dog, also a Gordon Setter, got four-course meals every night, no two of which repeat in any 30-day period. He sent me recipes. It was all organic. The dog meals included brewery yeast and bone meal, I remember. And at the end of the conversation, I thought, as a novelist, it would be professional malpractice for me not to meet this guy. And so I decided the rational approach was to drive in my pickup truck 2,000 miles and hand deliver this dog to him.
With a very, very crippled dog.
Yeah, yeah. One of the reasons that the trip was so ill-fated was that the dog, because it couldn't brace itself, had the ballistics of a bowling ball. When we'd go around corners, it would slam the door or ram into the glove compartment. It was incontinent and had to be lifted up in order to go to the bathroom, its back end, but then everything came streaming down me, so I had to put it into the wheelchair. I got halfway, I got 1,000 miles in a couple of days, had a nervous breakdown, flew the dog the rest of the way, and got to New York City and met this guy, and he put a show on that it was, you know, the greatest show on earth when I got there.
Tell us about your very first impression of him. Then you're at the airport.
Yeah.
There's this guy. What does he look like? How does he strike you?
Okay, well, it's not one of the themes of the book is the sort of rise of technology over the decade between meeting him and when he was arrested. And in 1998, I was traveling with my first cell phone, so I could update this Rockefeller on the delivery of his dog. And he told me before I landed over the cell phone that I'd recognize him. I'd be able to pick him out of the crowd because he was a dead ringer for David Hyde Pierce, the actor who plays the character of Niles on Frasier, a show which he told me was based on him. So I got to New York and I looked around for David Hyde Pierce and I did not see him, but I did see a very little kind of guy with a pink polo shirt and a pink cap and loafers without socks and a voice sort of like a miniature Great Gatsby, you know, old sport, oh, Walter, da 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 da. So that was Clark Rockefeller.
And he seemed sort of harmless to you?
He seemed annoying, instantly annoying. I call him in the book an annoying, diminutive hobbit of a man whose level of self-regard was almost delusional. But he was nevertheless fascinating and a great storyteller. And the first night I was in the city after delivering the dog, he had me to a private club atop the MetLife building, a midtown skyscraper, that looked down on Rockefeller Center. We had a table next to the window, no doubt chosen for its vantage over what he called the family's place. And at the end of dinner, he patted his pocket and he said, what do you say we take a tour? of the family's place. And he said, I have the key right here, the master key. And now my thoughts ran from, could there be a master key to Rockefeller Center? And then I thought, well, you know, it is one center, and
there's a door.
There's a main door, and should anybody wish to get to any part of it, there should be one sort of portal to it. So of course there's a master key, and you know, like most of Clark's lies, or boasts, or fabrications, your mind spun for so long trying to figure it out that he was on to the next one before you had. And so you just sort of set it aside like an unpaid bill and was, someday I will address the question of whether if there's one key to Rockefeller Center, you know.
So it's this sort of process of constant sleight of hand.
Yeah.
Where before you can impale one falsehood, another has been produced from the hat that you don't even know exists yet in this narrative that he's spinning you. And tell us about the apartment and the art in the apartment.
So at the end of dinner, it got a little late for a tour of Rockefeller Center. in any case, it was one of those invitations that is probably, you know, meant to be turned down or taken, you know, a rain check on. At the end of dinner, he said, well, come to my apartment tomorrow. I'd love you to see my art. And I was particularly interested in going because he said he lived next door to Tony Bennett, who he could hear singing through his walls. And I thought that would be nice to hear. I might even run into him in the hallway. And I went to the building. It was kind of this dowdy, just off Central Park South, apartment building that I could imagine stuffy, rich people living in. And I got to the apartment, he opened the door, and I was both underwhelmed and dazzled. I was underwhelmed by the fact the apartment wasn't that big, and there was only one piece of furniture, a couch that would Crate and Barrel would be embarrassed to sell, covered in dog hair. But behind it, on the walls, were maybe what were 50, 60, 70 million dollars worth of Jackson Pollock's, Mark Rothko's, William de Kooning's, giant abstract expressionist paintings. So many, in fact, that there wasn't room to hang all of them, and some of them were just leaning against the wall. While we looked at them, he would scratch at them because there was, he explained, dog hair on all of them, and also dog saliva. And he told me that he thought pets and art should coexist naturally. And the most impressive part of this display was not the art collection, but his neglect of it. I thought, my God, only a truly rich person can own a Rothko and not care if his dog licks it.
Great detail. I
mean, yeah.
That sells you, right? This is how rich people would...
I didn't know I was being sold, but in retrospect, realizing what was really going on, that was the coup de grace. After that, what could he do to seem not rich or not eccentric or not a Rockefeller?
Crazy eccentric billionaire guy, you're buying into this, and yet for this trip, which has proved to be arduous and very expensive for you, he's promised you a handsome stipend.
He lured me out with the thought that he would make a contribution to the Humane Society or pay me personally, or maybe I could make a contribution of a portion of my payment. I spent the entire trip imagining its size. And my truck got about 6 miles per gallon. I had to stay in motels. I had to take a last minute flight, and then I had to get back. So the total bill for the trip, probably $3,000 to $4,000 it cost me. The night we were at the Sky Club, he gave me an envelope, which I, in my gentlemanly, modest way, didn't open in front of him, just tucked in my jacket. And in fact, didn't open for an entire night, because like a lottery ticket that you're just sure is a winner, you don't want to spoil the surprise. After I saw his art, I went down on the street and I ripped open the envelope. Finally, the suspense was too much. You know, the cherries and the slot machines were spinning in my head, and it was for $500, you know. And I never said a thing about it. Decided a gentleman doesn't.
How
complain.
Did you? Yes, you rationalize that to yourself by, if he's a gentleman, I've got to behave like one too.
Remember when President Bush didn't know how to operate a barcode scanner? I thought, he's Clark Rockefeller. He doesn't know how much plane tickets and gas cost. He's living, this is $500, but it's actually $10,000 in 1948 money, which is how he counts. You know, he was a master storyteller, but I was just as good, except I told the stories to myself.
I was going to ask you just to read the first of the two or three passages from the book on page 62, the paragraph that begins, "Oh, maybe my egotism."
Yeah. Well, a lot of this book is an attempt to explain what you're already worried about, which is that I'm not fit to be on this earth. So I'm trying to explain in this passage, what is it about me that either drew him to me or made me susceptible to him? Or maybe my egotism was a homing beacon. Maybe it made me a more attractive mark. Our history ran both ways, a partnership, meaning that whatever I'd seen in him, he had also spied something in me. These characters read you, according to the books, and all the time they're talking, they're really listening, alert for pings and echoes. They use sonar, not questions. Clark never asked me questions. I suspect that one quality he tuned into early on was my collaborative listening style. Instead of shrinking from his loopy stories, I helped him refine them by teasing out their details and nudging them toward heightened vividness. It's one of the services Nick performs for Gatsby, consolidating his fabricated self by playing the role of the ideal audience. Clark would have also felt my eagerness not only to trust, but to be trusted. He'd told me in our initial phone call that his plane was in China with his wife, and yet there she was when I arrived with Shelby. I don't recall him explaining this inconsistency. I do recall noting it and saying nothing. What is it in people, or just in people like me, that would rather let a lie go by, would rather wish it away or minimize it than point it out and cause the liar embarrassment? Why would we rather have someone see us naked than see someone naked? Politeness, I'd always thought. The essence of politeness is feigned blindness. But Clark knew otherwise. He knew that my choice to spare him the slightest shame, to view him as he wanted to be viewed, stemmed from a selfish craving for an alliance. I would blink when he stumbled, go deaf when he misspoke. He could count on me.
Wow. So he sees something in you and something in him is calling to you. I wonder kind of, even though you don't, you're buying into his act. Mm-hmm. At this moment, though, are you nonetheless thinking, I'm going to be writing about this guy someday? Is that part of the contract that was going on even at that point, do you think?
When I went out to meet him, it very explicitly occurred to me that I might write about him. The killer instinct that a journalist or a fiction writer has was running hot in my veins. Once I got to know him and I understood his obsession with privacy, his concern for his own security, and so on, the Minnesota boy in me came out and I went, I can't take advantage of a friend. You know, as a journalist, how awkward it can be. You're at a dinner party and everybody's revealing their secrets, and then they look and say, oh, wait, there's a journal, you know. And you go, no, don't worry, carry on. I don't have that hat on right now. So once I took that hat off, I was at pains to remind him constantly that he could trust me, you know, that I could keep a secret. So in a weird way, I was proving to him over and over again what a true blue friend I was by not writing about him.
Right. You liked him and you wanted him to like you.
I think I liked myself, or I didn't like myself and I wanted him to like me. You know, I mean, there were reasons from my earlier life. I grew up on a farm in Minnesota and then in a little town, and I went off to Princeton as a young man expecting sort of acceptance by the big world, and instead, you know, I was shut out of the little clubs and the elite associations and made fun of by the rich kids I saw, and as I saw it, and not properly accepted. And that wound in me was still fresh when I met this guy, and it seemed to not throb as badly in his presence.
Right. And there's that great Scott Fitzgerald story, another boy from the Midwest, Winter Dreams, about the poor kid who collects the golf balls from the pond where the rich people play golf and presses his face against the glass window of the house where the girl lives who he knows he will never have. And it's that sort of metaphor for American aspiration. And one of the things, you know, I'm from England, obviously, and we all know that the English are obsessed by the class system, but I think Americans are equally obsessed by class, but in a different way. And I wondered what you thought about that.
In the way that the British are secretly obsessed with sex, but seem to be obsessed by class, Americans seem to be obsessed by sex and are secretly obsessed by class. You know, Fitzgerald and the Great Gatsby are no accident in this story, because I came from Minnesota. I went to my first year of college, McAllister College, was just down the road from Fitzgerald's house. I was very conscious of myself as a Minnesotan going east to Princeton as a, you know, someone who's following in Fitzgerald's footsteps. And here I met my friggin' Gatsby.
Right.
You know, here I met a Rockefeller. I was living out my fate. You know, he even claimed later on, much later in the story of our association, that he'd formed his entire life on the book, The Great Gatsby. I found out, in fact, that he said it was always been his favorite book, but I found out from a friend of his who'd known him earlier that, in fact, his favorite book was Trout Fishing in America. But so he may have been playing me there, too.
And with this class thing, I was going to ask you to quickly read another passage, or soon after the last one.
Yeah.
This was page 110, the Ellen Moore stuff, the description of that love affair that you have.
Let's see. Where should I start? Let's see. Well,
maybe at 30, having published.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This basically describes the real deep cut that I was trying to treat through my association with Clark. At 30, having published two books of fiction and moved out west in a fit of populist yearning, I betrayed myself again. One winter night in Montana, alone and drunk, I noticed a fetching author's photo on the back of a book of short stories in my bathroom. I'll call her Ellen Moore. I liked her bow-shaped lips, her taunting eyes. Her stories about her big New England family and her adventurous sex life in New York had made her famous. I wrote her a note reminding her that we'd met once at a party and telling her that I was coming to the city and would like to take her out. It worked. My boldness won her over. 10 days after arriving in New York, I rented a one-room apartment a few blocks from hers so we could see each other more easily. I quit drinking, quit smoking, and tweeded up my wardrobe. Ellen had gone to prep school and college with the Kennedys, John and Caroline, whom we ran into now and then. The encounters dizzied me at first. I'd forgotten how New York can act as a social particle accelerator. John wore a trucker's wallet on his belt, attached with a chain, and startled me with his earnestness. I'd expected him to be a smoothie, not a boyish idealist. Carolyn was tough and wry and seemed like a link to some lost era of high adulthood, perhaps that of her parents. She intimidated me. I even met Jackie with her cartoonish voice and aura of having known everybody worth knowing and tired of all but a few. Being among such people was a kick, but a kick that I got used to. I impressed myself by not dropping their names when I had the chance. Then Ellen broke up with me and instantly turned me from a semi-insider back into a fan, a gawker. There they were, John and Caroline on television, the one in my mother's living room where I ate a lot of hot soup after the breakup, attending a formal dress awards show named after their family and broadcast live from Washington, D.C. There they were on the covers of supermarket magazines back in Montana when I bought pancake syrup. Ellen's reasons for leaving me were simple. I didn't have enough money or the right friends. She wanted a bigger life than I could give her. It crushed me. I'd feared that her circle would close me out someday. In my closet hung a collection of jackets and trousers that I'd bought for our courtship at a swank department store. I emptied their pockets and gave them to Goodwill and resumed my grassroots rebel act with a vengeance. I'd been to the front and come back wounded. A grenade had blown up in my hand.
Wow. That's a great passage. So from 1998 to 2002, you're in touch with Clark Howe on the phone mostly?
It all makes sense in retrospect. He'd committed a murder in 1985, and he'd escaped one step ahead of the law and had been tracked almost to New York City, or had been, in fact, tracked to New York City, and he'd reinvented himself. So he controlled our relationship. I think I was convenient to him because I lived far away, and he knew I wasn't going to overlap with any of his other dupes or acquaintances. And so we spoke a lot on the phone. A few times I went to New York, met him at a private club. You know, he seemed to be a member of these clubs. In fact, he was a member of another club, and he was trading on the reciprocity privileges. But we went to the Lotus Club, and people said, "Mr. Rockefeller," and took his coat and brought him his gin and tonic the way he liked it. And, that was the nature of our relationship.
Right. And then my very favorite sequence in the book, of the many great sequences in the book, is this crazy visit you pay to him in 2002 when he's bought the estate in New Hampshire of Judge Learned Hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's living in this decrepit crackpot mansion, and he gets you out there on the pretext that you're going to assist him with the editing of novels
that he's been writing. Yeah.
Novels he's been writing.
Yeah.
And he puts off and puts off and puts off telling Walter what these novels are about until right at the end of the visit, when you ask him, "Well, what are these novels?" And he tells you...
Yeah, I said, "So what are these novels you want me to edit, you know, for a handsome stipend?" And he says, "Well, each book is a novelization of one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek." And then when I have the response that you just had, except a suppressed version of it, I say, "Oh, interesting, you know." He tells me, "Oh, he understands I've got it wrong. I must be thinking of Star Trek, the original series. His books are novelizations of Star Trek, The Next Generation, the far superior sequel."
And he's told you that he's bought at a secret auction Captain Picard's actual chair.
Yeah, he says he has the deck from the Star Trek, the captain's chair like this from the Star Trek Enterprise in a warehouse in Rhode Island. It's along with his collection of Buick Roadmaster station wagons and other things he's bought along the way. It's a secret from his wife, though. So if we see her, I'm not to mention them because he's been spending all this money on Star Trek memorabilia. I understand as a man, you know.
And, and this stuff is funny, but yet in this visit, there's a sense you get that this guy's life is running awry. Like his things aren't quite what they should be. The mansion's a slum. The wife's not really kind of quite there. He seems very unhappy. I'm getting the sense reading between the lines of that, okay, this is a moment when this guy was actually seemed to be under some kind of pressure.
Yeah, he was. Looking back, as I've been able to reconstruct his life, and there's been another book about this guy, so I had the benefit of, you know, other reporting on his life that filled in some of the blanks. But anyway, in New Hampshire, he was living in this mansion that's up on jacks. Windows are missing. You have to walk on boards over just bare studs down the hallway. The place isn't heated well. We go out to dinner. He makes me order whatever. He tells me to order whatever I want, makes sure that I order dessert, and then tells me he forgot his wallet. It was a mad visit. Two highlights of the visit. One, he told me when I got there, it was really too bad that I hadn't been there the week before because his friend Britney Spears had been there. And he said it was really sad that I couldn't come back next weekend because Chancellor Helmut Kohl of Germany was visiting. Who is then retired, so he might have been on sort of a, you know, world tour of things he'd missed in office. But then again, those two names in my head, they didn't cause skepticism so much as a cessation of neurological activity. And the fact that in the mansion's driveway were parked empty police cars with dummies in them. That also was something to ponder, but, you know. And when I finally got him to explain why the police cars were there, he said, oh, it has to do with my rocket research. I have a laboratory in Quebec which is doing speed of light propulsion system research for the Defense Department, and I'm afraid that this Chinese space program will kidnap me to keep the U.S. from making progress in this area. And he asked if I'd like to see a picture of the laboratory in Quebec, and I said, of course I would. And he showed me a picture of just an even canopy of trees taken from the air. And he said, right under all those leaves, that's where the laboratory is.
And these Star Trek novels, did they actually exist, or were they these?
I never saw them. I probably didn't show, didn't alert in the proper way. You know, like, oh my God, that's what the world needs. Let's let's get to work.
And do you think was this kind of Joe Gould's secret history of the world?
I wouldn't be surprised. Well, you know, Clark was a lazy person. Finally. People have said to me, "Why, if this guy had used all this intelligence for good, or for some industrious process purpose, he could have gone far." But that was the thing about him; he wanted the results without the effort. That's why he skipped straight to being a Rockefeller rather than, And so it was probably enough for him to say he'd written the books and get credit for it than to actually do the work. I don't know.
So the shoe drops finally in 2008 when you're separated from your wife, he's separated from his wife. Mm-hmm. There are absent daughters.
Yeah.
And he kidnaps his own daughter.
Yeah.
And there's a manhunt, and his pictures all over the media, and the Rockefeller family say, hey, he ain't one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still, at that moment, when your mother's telling you, Walter, I told you all along, you were still, you wanted to believe even then.
Okay, August 2008, there's a nationwide Amber Alert for Clark Rockefeller. He's kidnapped his daughter after a custody hearing. I wasn't surprised, because I knew he was very angry about the outcome of his divorce and the custody decision that was made. I think he's finally cracked. The Rockefellers disavow him. I see this on my computer. My girlfriend at the time was a journalist in the other room. I said, come here. She was on Facebook. I wasn't. I said, look at these Rockefellers, these cowards. This guy brings a little scandal on the family, and they throw him under the bus. You go on that Facebook thing, and you say that Clark Rockefeller is being very badly treated by his family. I don't know if she actually posted that, but I was incensed on his behalf. That's how deeply duped I'd been.
And then the moment when you have to accept it is
well,
what?
Well, it then comes out pretty clearly in the next few days that he's not a Rockefeller. He's this German kid who came over at 17 to Connecticut. He met some Americans while he was hitchhiking in Germany. They said, well, if you ever get to America, give us a call. 2 weeks later, he calls them. He's in America. He starts living with his family and watching the show Gilligan's Island and forming a upper-class, posh manor on the model of the millionaire, Jim Backus. It was actually testimony at his murder trial that he did this. And so anyway, I had to accept that he was not a Rockefeller and all of that. But then it comes out within a couple of weeks that he's a suspect in this gruesome 1985 murder near Pasadena in San Marino. And in the stories about it, it says he was living in a guest house of this family when he murdered these people. And I remembered suddenly a couple of months after I met, he asked if he could come live with me on a ranch. And on my ranch in Montana, I said I didn't have room. He said, do you have a guest house? And I said, well, I do have a little guest house. He says, well, I used to live in a guest house in California, and I've never been happier in all my life. And that's the memory of that conversation convinced me instantly that he was guilty. And then all of a sudden, all the bullshit over the years fell into place, and I realized this guy had been camouflaging himself in plain sight and was indeed capable of anything. And
your feeling then is what? At that moment is what?
Similar to my feeling if a seam opened in this stage and I fell through it into a aquarium tank of pink fish looking out on an audience of aliens. I mean, I just went, Walter, you really don't have a right to go outside really that bad, really that bad. I just went, what? It's like finding out your wife has, oh, come meet my other family or something, you know?
And then now is the moment, presumably, when you know there's going to be a book here.
Well, oh, okay. So, yeah. So
that's your
the real secret history of this whole relationship is me arguing with myself about whether I can write about him. I meet him. I think I'm going to write about him. Then I get to know him. I decide I can't. Then I find out he's an imposter and a murderer, at which point I have a very clear and memorable thought, which was, ka-ching. I've compared the experience to finding slipped into your high school yearbook a bond that matures at 18% annually, and which you stuck in there when you graduated from high school, and now you're 50 and you pull it out and go, my God, this thing's worth something.
And yet, that's 2008,
yep.
And we're in 2013.
Yeah, well, 2008, he goes to trial for kidnapping his 7-year-old daughter, and he's convicted. And this is in Massachusetts. And he goes to prison, and he's inaccessible in prison. And then they start the investigation of this murder in California, because they realized from his photographs that he was the same guy who had been calling himself Christopher Chichester, 13th Baronet of England.
And Christopher Crowe.
Brother of Cameron Crowe, at that time best known as director of Fast Times of Ridgemont High. He hadn't even done, like, Almost Famous yet. So it's 2008. This murder investigation drags on, and he is not tried for murder until exactly 1 year ago, a few blocks from here, in courthouses and I attend his murder trial. Very different man than I had known before, who I sat as far as I'm sitting from the lip of the stage, sat behind him and watched him.
And were you in touch with him at all in that time?
There was no way to be in touch with him.
Uh-huh.
Can I still be heard? Yeah.
Yeah.
He was incommunicado. His lawyers had separated him from the press and from anyone who, he might contact. So the first time I saw him was when I walked into that courtroom in March 2013, and he turned around to look at a juror who was being interviewed by the judge, and I was sitting 4 feet from him. And it was like locking eyes with a rattlesnake.
And he sneers at you.
Yeah, he one of the great things about this Clark Rockefeller was that in 1.5 seconds, he could come up with a story that took an hour to tell or a response that was just perfectly in character with some story he wanted to advance. And the first second was kind of like a rattlesnake, and then the next moment was, like, you aren't the gentleman you pretended to be. How dare you come and, you know, embarrass me at this hour of, you know, difficulty.
You're a brilliantly funny speaker, and yet there's a sort of righteous anger that runs through the book as you kind of walk around the speculation of just who the hell was this guy and how can a personality like this exist? And mm-hmm. you describe him in different ways. He has no self. He's a cannibal of souls, a stealer of stories, a snaky flim-flam artist. He's a brain tick, an entity, a vampire, a composite of ink and celluloid. He's Hannibal Mitty. He's Gatsby the Ripper. He's a murderous narcissist. He's the most prodigious serial imposter in recent history. He's the villain with 1,000 faces. The blithe wheeler dealer who blow up the world if he saw a profit in it, a kind of charming dark side cowboy perennially slipping off into the sunset and reappearing at dawn in a new outfit. So you were burned by this guy, though, and you were sort of by this point, I imagine, also a little scared by the idea of what might have happened to you. And your daughter comes out for the trial, and she asks you, Dad, did you like him?
Mm-hmm.
And you say...
Well, I say he was interesting, you know, and we're sitting there at the trial, and here sitting next to me is my 15-year-old daughter, the little girl who was in the womb when I went to deliver that dog. One of the reasons, doing my own psychobiography, I went to deliver that dog was I was looking for any diversion from the terror of impending fatherhood. And here I am with my little girl. He'll never see his again. That's already been determined. He kidnapped her, and she's gone to England with her mother. He'll never see her again. I've got my daughter. And she looks at him sitting there, and I've told her this story. This is your dad's old friend, you know. It was like the first Dodgers game, only it was your first murder trial. And it happens to be of Daddy's friend. And she looks at him and she says, you're lucky to be alive. And I didn't know, and it came out later as I was writing the book, when people gave me some information that I did not even have at the time of the trial, that I am lucky to be alive. But secondly, the thing that she said that was even more sort of from the mouths of babes profound was, I can't believe he's sitting right there and he knows everything. Because the entire trial consisted of people who had been fooled by him getting up to tell their stories. And a decades-old, very circumstantial case in which most of the remains of the body had been lost. 90-year-old witnesses coming up who'd been, you know, 60 at that time. Now they're not, or whatever. It was a huge expense and a huge circus for the city of Los Angeles, or the state of California, excuse me, to put this man on trial for murder. And he could have told us all what happened. There's still a woman who's never been found, presumed in the ground somewhere, who knows. And Maisie looked at her and he said, I can't believe he knows it all. And I wanted to say, that's the price of civilization. That's what makes us different than him.
Well, also, it's sort of... it turns out then that he stole the Star Trek thing from
yeah.
the guy that he'd killed. And then I wonder, would this guy actually be psychically capable of telling his own story in a straightforward way? I doubt whether
that's why he needed me, somebody said. And I'm not sure they're wrong. You know, think about, I say in the book, we all know you can't predict the future, but you also can't predict the past. When when all this information came out, I suddenly saw with new vision everything that had passed between us as having a whole different meaning. And he was a guy who'd committed what he thought was the perfect murder and probably at some level expected that it would come out. I mean, it must be frustrating to have your masterpiece buried in the ground. At some level, he might have wanted to know a writer because someday his story might be told, and he wanted a little bit of input. But in any case, you know, he is a monster, and I'll give you two examples of it. One, the Star Trek novels that he wrote were not an original interest of his. The man he killed, John Sohus, was a Trekkie. He'd watched each episode of Star Trek 150 times, his best friend estimated. When he went into the ground, Clark had no interest in science fiction. But once that personality was up for grabs, he adopted it. I got to, at the trial, see a friend of his say, Clark used to love to tell me about his ranch in Montana. And I realized that this guy was a borrower. He went around and he picked parts of your soul and he aggregated them to himself in order to seem to have a self.
And one of the scary things that you say in the book, that this kind of emotion communicates itself so forcefully, is we're all in danger a lot of the time, and that we suppose the world is what it seems to be, and often it isn't. I was just going to ask you to read that after the trial is over, an old court hand says you can... At this moment in time, this guy's going to have nobody to talk to. He's done. He's been found guilty. He's going to be lonely in the jail cell. If you ask for an interview, he's going to give you one. And you followed that advice, and lo and behold, you get to meet Clark one last time. So I wonder if you could read us the...
Yeah, again, it happened just blocks from here at the Men's Central Lockup here in L.A. I came out of the trial. He'd been found guilty. I sort of had a weird sense of, you know, I felt guilty. I'd had such revenge on this guy. I mean, I'd gotten to see him convicted and sent of murder and sent off to life in prison. And I thought my book was over, and I'd go write it now. And somebody said, no, just go down and visit him in jail. I said, well, you can't. His attorneys don't let him. He said, he just fired his attorneys. He's all alone down there. So I went and talked to him more than once, but this was one of the visits. Let's see. I don't know quite where to start. Maybe you have an idea.
Yeah. Let's say I made a note that if we jump in on 203, I worried I'd heard him coming.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I go into the jail on a Sunday morning, 11:30 in the morning, and I see him. I'm debating in my head whether I'm going to ask him if he committed the murder, if I'm going to lead with that. I'd never asked such a question of a person and wasn't certain I could form the words. This bothered me. It seemed cowardly and weak. But what bothered me more was that if I didn't ask, Clark would discern my weakness and might exploit it in the psychic realm, if not the physical. Before today's visit, this might have seemed absurd, an astral assault conducted through the ether. But now that we were head to head, possibly near enough to generate crackles of blue static, I worried. I'd erred in coming. I wasn't a materialist. My faith in glass partitions wasn't strong enough. I blamed my years as a Mormon, a ghostly sect rife with otherworldly folklore, golden plates translated by second sight, plagues of crickets stopped by prayer. But I also blamed my mother's recent death, which had opened holes in my reality. I'd seen an unusual number of crows since losing her, messenger birds that appeared at Poe-like moments when I was alone and she was on my mind. Symbolic spoked wheels kept turning up as well, in songs, in poems, in art. They seemed to be versions of the Bighorn Medicine Wheel, an ancient Native American rock altar located on a mountain in Wyoming that I was heading off to visit
the day I got the news of her collapse. Tell me about the murder. There, I'd done it. I'd shown the devil I was brave. Oh, that, Clark said. Well, there's not much I can say. I'm innocent. It wasn't me. That jury, you see, never liked me very much. They would have convicted me of anything. The Kennedy assassination, anything. It was all a mistake. They'll have to overturn it. I'm absolutely confident they will. So who killed John Sohus? Out came the secret pencil. He had a pencil hidden in his shirt. He didn't use it right away. First, he denigrated his attorneys, particularly Denner, who he said was too old and frail to practice law. He lowered his voice conspiratorially and leaned closer to the glass. He may have had a stroke during the trial. The charge was horrible and patently false. The act of speaking it left a ratty ring around his mouth. His next target was Linda Sohus. She'd killed her husband, he said, and fled the country, probably to Mexico. We've turned up some leads, he said. We, the pronoun fit. There were many of him, all sharing the same skull, the psychotic we. He started writing, block letters again, like on a ransom note. He held up the scrap of paper so I could read them. Occult witch. I spoke the words aloud for the bugged phone. I wasn't supposed to, which was why I did it. You're a very good guesser, he said. That's what she was.
Wow. Now, you say almost as if casting your own wish in at the end of this, that this would be the last time I ever saw Clark, and yet he's still reaching out to you through anonymous reviews on Amazon and stalking you through Twitter. And tell us a little bit about that and how that is not quite all over.
Well, so this interview in jail happened in April 2013. The last time I then saw him in jail again, and the last time I saw him was August 25th, the day he was sentenced to life in prison, and the day he sort of was not allowed to make a motion for dismissal and was sent off. I did, when I saw him go through that door, think, not just good riddance, but, you know, may I never see this guy again. In jail, he had wound me up and reeled me in again. I mean, you have to read the book, but even knowing he was a murderer, knowing he was a con man, knowing he was an imposter, he managed to get inside my head in jail, not unlike in The Silence of the Lambs, and sort of offer to answer certain mysterious questions if I kept coming back. And by the time I saw him go off to life in prison, I literally had torn myself away from the relationship. He'd asked me to be his official biographer, for one thing, in prison. I'd still be doing that in 2097 and trying to get the real story. But anyway, so then I published this book, you know, fast forward. He was very aware in jail of everything that had been written about him. He was horribly aware of it. One time I came in to see him, and the Boston Marathon bombing had just happened, and I said, did you hear about this? I know you used to live in Boston. He says, yes, it's terrible, terrible, but perhaps for me not so terrible because, you know, in Boston all they do is talk about me. Now they have something else to talk about. And so he's very aware of press about him. This book was published. Immediately, one-star reviews started showing up on Amazon. There would be one a day, and all of them had the same point. I expected a book about the fantastically cunning and incredibly fascinating imposter, Clark Rockefeller. Instead, I got a book about the neurotic and boring writer, Walter Kern. and one of these reviews was signed Christopher Corcoran, using his classic initials. I'd even given a Fresh Air interview to Terry Gross a couple days before, saying how he loved to use the initials CC. In the book, in fact, the first time I met him, the first time I spoke to him on the phone, I was at the time reviewing books, and he said, oh, I just wrote my first book review for a new thing called Amazon.com, and he sent it to me. So the day that these reviews started appearing, That review, which had been on there since 98, which can only be withdrawn by the person who wrote it, went off the site. There have been Twitter people whose only follower is an orange with a smile painted on it, and whose profile picture is Marlon Brando in Last Tango in Paris, who I suspect he, with a smuggled cell phone or some form of periodic internet access, is sending my way.
And how does that make you feel? Does that alarm you? Does it amuse you? Is it, at this point, do you have enough distance on that? Are you still creeped out by this guy?
Well, if he wasn't doing it from behind walls, I'd feel a lot worse. But, you know, this book is, to be serious, this book is meant, and the reason I wrote it, is to dispel a lot of myths that we use to comfort ourselves in life. I mean, I'd like to be completely uplifting, but I have some troubling news to report. Number one, you are much more gullible than you think. And if you think there's no one fooling you in your life, it's just because you haven't caught them yet. Number two, the same time Clark was arrested and shown to be an imposter, Bernie Madoff and the Lehman brothers, whoever they really were, and so on, were revealed to have taken a lot of the world's money and thrown it away. We went to war in Iraq over weapons of mass destruction that were a lot like the key to Rockefeller Center. Somebody patted his pocket and assured us they were there, and we saw them in our imagination, but they weren't. And a lot of people died for that lie. So liars and con artists exist at all walks of life, and we collaborate with them because we have fragile senses of selves, because we love a good story, because the world is more interesting when it's enchanting than when it's a grind. And sometimes that is a jolly and entertaining process, and sometimes it's a tragic process. This is somewhere in the middle. I'm troubled continuously by this thought. In the age, sometimes I like to think Clark came from the future, or I fear that he came from all of our future. And I mean that in this way. Never before have we, on a daily basis, dealt with so many people who are just a picture and a story. Social media really involves us in the lives of people who could be anything. And not just imposters. It turns us into imposters. You know, the false self in me was what was drawn to the false self in him. And every one of us, every day, is going from one audience on social media to another on the cell phone to another here in front of us. And our selves are becoming more and more a set of performances aimed at different audiences in different situations. And I like to think that in some ways Google may have made us safer from each other. We can check on each other. But at the same time, our incredibly mediated technological world has made us vulnerable and also made us practitioners of a kind of deception that this guy practiced assiduously but is becoming everybody's property in a way. The book is kind of a call for a little bit of humility before the thought that we are such great judges of reality and of character. It's better to know your limitations than to get swept up in one of these cons.
Right. So we've got some time for questions. If
was his mental illness ever diagnosed, and was that part of the reason why he didn't go? Why it wasn't a capital offense, and he wasn't, and he's not on death row?
I'm curious why you suggested he had a mental illness. No, I really am.
I'm not a practitioner, but I would think that he was suffering from some kind of clinical delusion, narcissism, and probably an entire litany of.
Well, there's another myth that makes us all feel better about reality. He was the least delusional person I've ever met. How could he have kept 17 different personalities and names, all of them aimed at different audiences, in place if he was at all fooled by any of them himself? This is a totally calculating, totally manipulative, totally alert human being. Number two, calling what he has a mental illness really doesn't do much, except maybe make us feel better. He would never consider himself mentally ill. He never sought out treatment. And people don't come up to you on the street and say, you exhibit the signs of delusional narcissism. I'd love to help you. Could you come to my office? You know, so, I mean, what you know, diagnosed, there's no one to diagnose him. He doesn't want the diagnosis. And the diagnosis is simply that of what? Sociopathy, which is a set of behaviors. I don't think knowing what name to give this is any help, finally. Yeah.
This is just a simple question of some of the elaborate deceptions that he set up that one is swept away and kind of as you are, the reader, you know, the kind of what's behind the illusion. So what were those paintings? Why were they in there?
The paintings were great counterfeits. While I was looking at them, a Museum of Modern Art restorer came in to clean them. I'm convinced that it was actually a restorer. It may have been an actor we hired to make the whole setup look more realistic, but there were, from other reporters reporting and other writers reporting, it's clear that he had major gallerists in New York convinced that these paintings were real. They were all phony. They were all fake.
What do we know about his life before he came to Connecticut, or where you said he came, and what explanation, if any, do you have for his life thereafter?
I'm going to be real hard-ass tonight because I only have a little time here, and I've had an experience that gives me some insight that you might not have just watching Oprah. There is no reason that he became who he was that is traceable to his childhood. In other words, in America, we love to console ourselves with the thought that people who do evil had something bad done to them. And if we're just all nicer to each other, there'll be less evil in the future, especially if we're nicer to children. But it's just not true. His lawyers tried hard in his kidnapping case to find evidence in order to mount an insanity defense, which he objected to. He wouldn't allow one in the murder trial. To find evidence of some kind of abuse or trauma in child, they couldn't find any. His dad wasn't the nicest guy, and his mother was kind of like a Tennessee Williams character, you know, sort of Blanche DuBois. She had gentleman callers, maybe. But that's not enough to cause somebody to cut people up, bury them in the yard, and then, as he did, play a game of Trivial Pursuit on the grave with his friends. He was, since he was a little kid, a bully, mischievous. He used to have this trick where he'd come up to people and he'd say, look what I have, as though maybe he had a little frog or something in his hand. And they'd look and he'd blow pepper right up their nose into their eyes. This guy loved to be in the advantageous position. He was arrogant, and he was that way for as long as anybody has known him. And his family, it has been no help. They feel that he was born this way, and I see no evidence to the contrary.
Did you spend time with his wife, and was it your impression that she figured him out at some point, or did she just divorce him because he wasn't an...
I didn't spend much time with her. She testified at the trial. She was a very remote presence the few times I met her, the couple of times I met her. People can't believe that somebody could be married to somebody like this and not know. And yet I'm convinced she's telling the truth when she says she didn't. She met him in 1994. She was a Harvard MBA, very driven, very smart woman. And she said at the trial, guys didn't ask me out. You know, they were threatened by me. And here comes this guy with roses and champagne and, you know, a line of romantic talk. And I was bowled over. And I think she was being genuine there. And what happened was she tried to get away from him around the time I visited, a little before that. And instead, he got her pregnant. In a way that wasn't completely with her cooperation, if you can imagine that. Then when she did find out he was lying in 2006, her father actually found out through a Google search of a woman that Clark said was his mother and claimed was dead. He said his mother was a Hollywood actress named Ann Carter, but she died when he was young. And the father did a Google search and found out that there was indeed an actress named this, but she was alive, and called his daughter. Daughter ran a check on her husband, like, who is he? They came back and said, we don't know who he is. He doesn't have any public record. He's a cipher. And she then divorced him. So, you know, it's, as in my case, people can't believe you, a journalist, could be fooled. People can't believe that she was fooled as his wife. But I think she's telling the truth. She was a very high-powered business person who spent a lot of time traveling. I think she just, as in a lot of marriages, avoided him most of the time.
Do you regret meeting him?
The writer in me doesn't regret it at all. The human being regrets it somewhat. But I would have met somebody like him at a lesser level eventually. We all meet somebody who sees the blind spots in us, who grasps our weaknesses and vulnerabilities at some point. Often it's a lover, sometimes it's a business partner, whatever. The human being in me also regrets it because ever since this happened, I don't trust people in the same way I used to. I just can't. I remember a plumber asking me right after, about a month after he'd been caught, if he could take a key to my place, and while I was on vacation, he'd come in and fix a tub that was leaking. I said, no way. I also remember, I was single at the time, and online dating was getting going. And I turned on Match.com, and looked through it, and I remember thinking, how do I know who these people are? What will I be getting into if I plunge into this damn thing? And over, I found myself caught up short. I like to think it's for my own good, but sometimes it's a little obsessive, you know?
Other than through his wife, how did he fund his life?
He didn't have to fund it any other way because his tastes weren't really all that grand. I mean, the phony art probably didn't cost him much. He didn't spend anything on furniture. Every time I went to see him, there was either no food or I paid. His house was under permanent construction. His wife made millions of dollars a year. I mean, a lot of money as a McKinsey management consultant traveling all over the globe. And at the trial, they showed the contents of a storage locker of his that they'd unearthed, and in it were book after book of blank checks signed with her name. She'd just turned over checkbooks, and he also used to sort of abuse her, sometimes maybe lock her in rooms, not let her eat, torture her psychologically if she spent too much on the credit cards or whatever. So he had a total call on all her money. And who knows what other little scams he was running here and there. So, you know.
Hi. What was the motive for the murder? Did that ever come out in the trial, or do you have a feel for that?
That's a big concern of my book. On a very literal level, it would seem that he wanted an inheritance that was bound for this young man. You see, the way he committed the murder, he made it seem that the young man and his wife had disappeared, and he had letters forwarded from Paris, postcards, that made it seem that they had just run off to Paris and abandoned the mom and were having a fine old time. And until the yard was dug up 9 years later for a swimming pool, these people were simply thought to be missing. And then they found the husband's remains. He tried to get into the, he through some intermediaries, he worked his way into the will of the woman who thought her kids had abandoned her. And when she died, she left her money to some caretakers who he had kind of put with her. And he came back to split the take, and there wasn't any money left. But I don't really think that was the primary motive. To murder some people so that a few years down the line you might get an inheritance from a woman who isn't even dying yet, maybe. he was obsessed with film noir. He was obsessed with the literature of the perfect murder. He was obsessed with the board game Clue. He threw parties in which people dressed up for the board as characters in the board game Clue, murder mystery evenings after he'd committed a real murder. I think he wanted to prove his intelligence, his cunning, and so on by committing the perfect crime. If you read the book, you'll see that the crime and its cover-up have uncanny resemblances to the murder in The Talented Mr. Ripley and to the murder in the Hitchcock movie Rope. Hitchcock was his favorite director. I think he wanted to graduate from mere imposterhood to having the power of life and death and the sort of Dostoevskian ability to fool everybody and prove his own masterful intelligence.
This is fascinating. The idea of you getting to know him and that threat being created, like your well-being coming under threat, do you feel in some way quite lucky that you were duped? Because if you would have started, you know, if you would have put the journalist hat on, it might have led to you sort of connecting or finding that the dots didn't connect and that you would have dug up the idea that, I don't know, that you would have been a target of his ire, well, I guess.
Okay. As I understand what you're saying is, are you glad that you didn't question him and investigate him at the time because you might have found out that he wasn't telling the truth? You might have gotten close to the notion that he was a murderer, and to defend himself, he might have killed you. That is a possible alternative path for our relationship. This is a book about the forking paths that we take in life and how we create each other's fates in ways that we can't imagine through our alliances with others who may or may not be who they seem. I have thought about that, and I've wondered at times if one of the reasons he wanted a writer and a journalist close to him was to monitor, in some sense, how convincing he was. He earlier in his time in the United States, he would try out his stories on people who kind of knew he was telling stories, and he would find out which ones got a laugh, which ones were too incredible, which ones were believable. And I sometimes think that I was kind of a test screening audience, as it were, for a lot of tales and things that he was telling. If I had ever become unconvinced, he could have easily cut me out, you know, because I lived far away. So I'm not sure what might have happened if I'd started digging, but I think he instantly saw past my pose as a grown-up and a Princeton graduate to the little boy in Minnesota who just wanted the rich guy to like him, you know.
So Walter's going to be signing copies of this fantastic book. Many thanks to the LA Public Library and Aloud. Many thanks to all of you for coming out tonight. And many thanks to you, Walter Kerr.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.